violate.
How do you get it, like, props?
Right.
We have to, like, automatically.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our third class on processes and their interface. Right, on Tuesday, we were talking about how the parent process, and then when we call fork, the child process, how those can interact. Today, we're going to continue that discussion, getting back to some of those shell operations that we've been using, right, as users of systems, and now we can see how actually we can implement that. And hopefully, sort of start to realize that it's not really magic. The shell isn't really doing all that much. It's just we have some very useful system calls that can basically provide the type of functionality we want when interacting with the command line. And then we will sort of lead into the next topic, which will be virtual memory. Anything before we get rolling? Okay, let's jump back in then. So sort of where we kind of left off last time is you're looking at some of the typical use cases we would have for in the shell, where in this case we want to go run this program, and because we have we've sort of specified the relative path, right? So this is probably a program that we wrote, right? And you run your programs this way often, right? So something that, you know, maybe we created, and rather than have all of its output just go to the terminal, which is more sort of for interacting with us, we want to actually save it to or write it to an output file. Right, and so if you're, say, for instance, taking a bunch of timing measurements, maybe you actually want that to write the timing measurements to an output file that you can then later analyze. All right, so we're cool with that. So how do we actually make this happen? Well, basically, we need a two-step process. So first, we need to set up the output file, set up output.txt. Okay, we need to have a file that we can actually write to. Okay? That kind of makes sense. Now, the trickier part is we want to make that output file be standard out. Now, what does that mean? Basically means we want when that program runs, it's just going to use, say, printf like normal. Or maybe it's explicitly writing to standard out, right? It's just designed that so when you run it like normal, it would just print in the terminal. And we're just going to tweak it a little bit. We're not going to change the program. We're just going to sort of set it up a little bit differently so that now when it writes to what it thinks is standard out or to the terminal is actually writing to this file. And so what that means is we're going to have to change the file descriptor 1, which is standard out, to actually be our new file. So how do we do that? Well, turns out that with our abstraction of file descriptors, this is actually pretty doable, and one of the main reasons why file descriptors are designed the way they are. So we saw this struct before, right? This is sort of our kind of all-encompassing process state and resources struct that's somewhere here in the kernel. And within that, we have an array. And this is an array of file descriptions. Right, so whatever, so this type, this struct, open file descriptions, and you know it's just called files. But notice this, right? So we're not actually sort of allocating an array of these full open file descriptions, right? We just have an array of pointers to those file description structs. Now, this is useful for a couple reasons. One, for our discussion today. Two, this is an array of pointers is likely going to be much smaller than if we had to allocate space for the entire file description object. And since we have this sort of static size array of this, and we're doing this per process, and we're doing this sort of speculatively, because we kind of assume that the process will probably want to open some files. We don't know exactly how many. And so we don't necessarily want to allocate all of those resources up front. All right, so just being able to allocate pointers makes that a bit nicer. But it's important to remember that this is an array of pointers, right? And so when we have sort of our array here with a whole bunch of entries. Now, what does that first pointer point to? Does anyone remember? Yeah.
Standard in,
yes. So that points to a file description for that represents standard in. Right now, okay, so that's index 0. Index 1, that's what we're interested in right now. Right, so that's going to point to standard out, and so on and so forth. Okay, so now that we have this array of pointers, how can we do this where we want standard out to now point to this file instead? Well, we basically want to change the pointer that's in index 1. And what that's going to mean is that now file descriptor, or file descriptor 1, which is the index into this array, instead of pointing to standard out, is going to point to, say, you know, somewhere else here, where now we have our output.txt file descriptor or description set up. So we can basically remove one pointer, put in our new pointer, and now when that process calls write with index 1 or standard out, it's going to look up that file, use that file descriptor, look up that open file description, it's going to point to our file, and we'll write there. What does that look like in code? Well, that's what this is here, right? So what seems like it should be a fairly complicated process, right? Like, okay, we're going to not write to terminal, write to a different file, right? You know, that's got to take, you know, a lot of complexity, right? Well, actually, because we set up the data structure in a very strategic way, it's really just this one assignment. And this is sort of the type of functionality that good system design gives us. Right? We can implement some really important functionality, and the logic is actually fairly simple. Right? Because we made this struct an array of pointers, this works pretty nicely. Right? And so now we avoid a lot of complexity in the kernel, a lot of things that could cause bugs. Right? We have a much simpler way to do this, and that's actually really quite nice. Okay. Now, this is sort of what's happening internally, right? So this line of code, process files, you know, basically is setting this thing, right? This isn't something that a process can do, of course, right? Because this is state that's stored by the kernel. So the kernel owns this, it's tracking it on behalf of the process. A process absolutely can't interact with this directly because that would be very, very bad, right? Because that would give processes sort of way too much control and they could mess things up. So this is happening within the kernel. How do we tell the kernel what to do? Well, we have a system call. Right, and now we have this sort of much more narrow interface, and then the kernel can do this on our behalf. So the system call for this is called dupe2, duplicate, where basically we're going to do exactly this operation. So we're going to say this is the file descriptor we want to update, and then we want to up over here, and then we want to update it with our new file descriptor. So whatever file descriptor we just opened. In this case. Questions? Yeah.
So the redirection operator shell, is that a program or is that a feature of the command line or how is that implemented?
Yeah, so this redirection operator here. What is this? Well, we've seen sort of what has to happen to make the sort of behavior we want. Now, the way this is implemented is our shell, what we typed this string into, right? So whatever, we basically would have sat there in the terminal, we typed that in. The shell is going to take that string and then parse it. And then realize that, okay, I know what to do with this sort of closing angle bracket. That means that we're doing a output redirection. And so the shell is going to interpret this, understand that character, and then handle that according to the syntax of command line and how that shell works. Right, and so this is one operator. We saw last time we have a pipe operator, which we'll talk about. These are things the shell is going to interpret and then do this setup for us. Other questions? Yeah?
Just to clarify, that second to last line where we make the file description, we change it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just summarized by dupe2? Is dupe2 the macro to just do that process, or is that a separate thing entirely? Am I not understanding that?
Okay. So basically, how do these two things relate at the bottom here?
Yeah.
So the system call is our interface as application programmers. Right. So this is what we can put in our program that runs in user space, and that requests that the kernel do the action described by this line of code above here. So this line of code is essentially representing what the kernel has to do in response to a system call that we ask for it in our application, in our program. Now, I'm trying to be a little bit careful. This isn't an exact one-to-one mapping. I mean, it's not literally just this line of code. We have to do some other checks and whatnot. But the intent is basically that line of code. And that's happening within the kernel. All right. So back to our two steps here. So opening the output file, I think that one we've seen a few times now, right? And you've certainly done that. Making it the new descriptor, that's what we're going to call dupe2. And the structure of this is we take in the old file descriptor and the new file descriptor. Sometimes those names are not always the most intuitive, but the syntax here is that we're going to make whatever we put in as new file descriptor refer to the same thing as whatever we give as old file descriptor. So that's why we put standard out on the right, because we want standard out to refer to this new file that we just opened. And so that way, when this program just writes to standard out like normal, it actually gets written to a file. Now, it's okay if this new file descriptor is already being used. The kernel will just close that for us and then be able to reuse that index. And so if there was already a pointer, a valid pointer in that index in the array, we wouldn't want to just leave that, whatever memory it's pointing to, just sort of lost, right? I'm going to clean up that memory and then replace it with the new pointer that we're asking for. Okay. And so this has another important ramification, which is that nothing else is changing here, right? We're not sort of opening a new file, we're not copying that actual description, we're just adding a new pointer to it. And so everything else is going to be the same. So whatever we were doing with the old file descriptor, that's all still going to be there, and the new file descriptor will basically, you could think of it as pick up right at the same place. So like, for example, they're both going to have the same location in the file. Because that actual file description is, there's still just one of those. So where the kernel's keeping track of, like, where did you stop reading in this file? Or where are we in this file for writing? That state is the same for both of these file descriptors. Okay, and we'll see an example of that, which I think will make it a little bit more sort of clear kind of what the ramifications of that are. Okay, so if we put all these things together, we can look at an example here. Okay, and so this is still implementing our same use case. We might start by flushing whatever's sort of on the way to standard out currently. So for example, if we haven't hit like a new line character, this will tell the system, whatever we were sort of writing up to this point, finish writing. Right, actually send it to the write system call. Now we have our open. Right, nothing too surprising there. Open our output file, and open returns the file descriptor. Now this can error, right? It's possible that we don't have permissions, or we can't open a file for some reason, and so we would handle that. Let's assume that it did succeed, and so we actually got a valid file descriptor. Now we can call our dupe to system call. And we're using our new file descriptor is standard out. So that's what we want to now refer to the exact same open file as old file descriptor, which is the file descriptor we just opened. And at this point, essentially what we have, and kind of where the name of the system call comes from, is we now have two file descriptors, which are just two integers, two indexes into that array, which refer to the same file. And so we could write either one of them, and they'd have the exact same behavior. Because effectively, from the kernel's point of view, it's doing the exact same operation. Slightly different lookup into that file descriptors array, or otherwise, exact same operation. Does that make sense? Now, we don't need this this file descriptor that we had, right? So we can close it. Right? So that's just sort of extra resources that we don't need to use. We can just use standard out at this point. Now, the key here is that we're closing the file descriptor, right? So basically, just that integer to the array will no longer have any sort of, like, it won't mean the same file. It's possible we could call open again and get that same number as a file descriptor that refers to some other file, but we don't need it to refer to this file, but that's just the descriptor. That underlying description is still there, still referred to by standard out. And like we talked about last time, close, because there's something else that points to the same resources, won't deallocate the underlying sort of open file. So this isn't actually going to close the file. And now we still can use standard out to write to that, right? And so now we can call something like printf, which by default is going to use standard out, and it'll write that string to the file. Questions? Yeah.
Let's say you do this and you duplicate alpha.txt. Is that a standard out? Do you now no longer have a pointer to the standard out structure? And it's lost.
So now that we've done this, right? So say we write this program. Do we have a sort of a file descriptor for standard out anymore? No. Right? Right.
Unless you like duplicate it somewhere else.
Yes. And so if we wanted to be able to return and go back and say, okay, I don't want to output to this file anymore. I want to go back to standard out. But I still want printf to sort of work like this. So I still want file descriptor 1 to mean to be, in this case, output.txt. But I want to later be able to go back to sort of writing to the terminal. Then yes, we want to call dupe 2 again before this. Essentially, you could think of it as saving the standard out to somewhere else, to some other new file descriptor. Then we could call this. And so now, when the kernel sees this, it goes, oh, we actually have multiple things, multiple file descriptors that point to the same thing, so I won't actually close the full resource. And then we could call dupe 2 again later and restore standard out to file descriptor 1. Right. So where do we save it to? So we can save it to any valid file descriptor that we know isn't being used, or even if it is being used, it'll close that. We can also call, I think, just dupe 1. Just basically does exactly what we want. Makes a copy, and we're not setting the new value. Yeah.
What's the risk if you don't close file descriptors other than wasting a bit of memory?
What's the risk if you don't close file descriptors? Yeah, I think the main risk is just the resource use. It's possible that your program would later try to maybe use a file descriptor, and if you had closed it, you would be able to get the correct error and sort of detect that you had done something you didn't intend to, rather than it just kind of working. But primarily, it's a matter of just freeing resources. All right. So, even with like multiple lines of comments, right, this is that setup to do that redirection. And if at this point, instead of calling printf, right, we could call, let's say, exec. And then from there, we were sort of running this new program with these particular file descriptors set up. How does that work? How can we see that? So we can think of that in terms of back to our sort of structure here, right? So we have our array of pointers to open file descriptions. Now we can understand these system calls in terms of how they interact with this array. So open, right? Basically, we're just finding a new file descriptor in that array and allocating the resources to open the file and assigning it, right? And so this is, again, if we have this is our array here and a bunch of entries, right? Somewhere in here, we're basically just assigning that pointer to some new object for new, or for, sorry, for open. As we saw, if we want to duplicate, we're just taking somewhere and adding a pointer to, say, the same object. And then if we close, right, we're just removing we're removing that pointer. All right. Now, we've said a few times that fork does this full deep copy. So, and that includes the file descriptors, right? And so what is that doing? Well, this is another sort of really important implication of this design, is that we're copying the pointers. Right, so here you can see, right, this is our child process files at each index. We're just copying the pointer from the parent. So what's that gonna do? That means that the file descriptors, right, those indices are still valid in both versions, right? So the parent and the child. But they still point to the same thing, right? So whatever file was open in the parent is open in the child. And they have access to both. So this is, of course, very useful, right? Because this is how our child process will be able to have access to, say, standard out, right? If we started with no file descriptors, right, how would we write to standard out or read from standard in our child process and program? We couldn't. So this allows us to do that. Right? This also has some pretty important consequences, right? So if we do a fork, but our parent program has opened a bunch of files, that child process has access to those same files. Now, right, when we call fork, you know, we're still in our same program. And so, like, we get to choose, as the program creator, what happens in that child process. And so we can be aware of this and we can address this appropriately, but it is something we should be keeping in mind. Now, we don't have exec on the slide, but exec, when we run that new program, as we saw, it's removing the memory, but it's leaving this data structure of files alone. And so when we exec and run a new program, it has, again, the same files will be open. And so this is even more important to be thoughtful about, because now we're not running sort of our code in the sense we're running some other program. And if it's got files open that maybe it shouldn't have, that could be potentially problematic. All right. Questions on this interface and sort of how the system calls kind of map to modifying this structure? Okay, so I promised some examples of the ramifications for this and being able to duplicate these file descriptors. So let's look at some different examples here. Okay, so what's going on? We're assuming we have some file contains two characters, okay? We can open that twice. All right, nothing surprising there. Now let's read from each of those file descriptors one character, so basically the first byte of that of what's in that file. And what do we see? Right, so our output for both cases, is going to be the first character. Which, if we weren't having the discussion and all the previous slides, you'd be like, yeah, of course, right? Because we wouldn't even be thinking about this, right? You open the file twice, sure expect that we're going to read the beginning of the file twice. Right, so this is sort of the common case, right? Nothing should be really surprising about this. Because we have essentially two completely separate views into the same file. Just happens to be the same file. And we're just reading. Okay, good with that? So where does this become more complicated? Same file, right? Same contents. Okay, now we're calling open just one time, right? Give the file descriptor. Now we duplicate it. And we say, okay, this new file descriptor 100, I want that to be a copy of the file descriptor I just opened. So now we still have our two file descriptors, but they're referring to not only the same sort of underlying file in the file system, but they're referring to the same open file description. And so the resources that the kernel's tracking to know like where we've read in that file, so we call read again, those are being updated by both file descriptors. And so what the implication of that is that we call read on our original file descriptor, because that's still open, right? We didn't call close on that. So we can still do this. We can read into C1 byte, we'll get the first byte. Right, and that's what we see here. Okay? But when we read with the second file descriptor, because that points to the same underlying object, well, it's going to read one byte from where we left off. Just like we would expect if we read the same file twice any other time. Except now we have kind of a different kind of name for it, this different file descriptor, and so we read the second byte. Good? So if we walk through this, right, and we're really thinking about, okay, what's happening, what's the underlying, sort of how's the kernel handling this, what are the underlying resources, this kind of makes sense. Now, if you try to look at this really quickly, right, and just kind of glance at it, it might not be sort of obvious what's happening here, right? So some of the times this takes a little bit of sort of, okay, what's really going on here, line by line? Any questions on this? Anything that wasn't clear? All right. How about one more example? A little bit more complicated now. Okay, same setup. Still have AB, still open the file, okay? So that hasn't changed. Now, however, we use our old friend, fork. Okay? Remember how I told you that we were sort of always going to have this structure? Well, you know, still here, right? So we're assuming fork is succeeding in this case, but, all right, fork and then if. Because we want to differentiate. Is this the child or is this the parent? Anyone remember if we're in this first sort of branch of the if statement, which process are we in?
The child process.
The child, okay, good. Right? We're getting some intuition on that, that's great. Okay, so now what's this doing, right? So we can look at this and say, okay, we've got our normal if statement after fork, we're checking that we're in the child in the first branch, And so we're calling read. And in the parent, we are doing the same thing, we're calling read. We have a sleep in here, so we're sort of giving some time for the operating system to run the child process before continuing to run the parent process with our sleep here, and then we're calling our read. So what do we expect to happen? Well, we open the file one time, so we add the file descriptor. Now we did fork, which does a complete copy, but it copies that files array, which is a bunch of pointers. So the pointers are the same, meaning they point back to the same object. And so in both processes, we're referring to that same open description that we had, referring to foo.txt. And so when we read from one, we read the first byte, that increments our seek pointer of where we are in that file. And so when the parent eventually is rescheduled later and does the read on that, on the same, it'll be the same number, right? The same sort of integer descriptor, but in its process, the kernel is referring to the same open description and reads from wherever any other previous read left off, and so it'll read the next byte. And so that's why we get the child read the first byte, parent read the second byte. Yeah.
So if the sleep and the else function meant for the parent weren't there, does that mean that there's a chance that it could be C equals B, D equals A instead? Or
yeah, so okay, what question is basically if this wasn't here, what's likely, you know, what's gonna change here? It's entirely possible then that D would be A and C would be B. We don't know. Right? It depends on which process the operating system decides to schedule. Sleep is kind of our tool to sort of help us nudge the OS in the right direction, because the OS is really, it's really not trying to sort of do just nothing. And so if one process is sleeping but the other one's ready to go, it should run that one. I mean, technically, right, we still can't, with just this setup, we can't guarantee that we still wouldn't get the other order. Right, because maybe the operating system goes off and runs some completely other process in the meantime, and then the sleep finish or the sleep one is done, and so it's like, okay, I'll run that process, and that actually runs first, and then it gets around to the child process. Right? We're essentially helping our odds considerably, but without some sort of explicit coordination, where we're not guaranteed a certain ordering. What else? That's right. So fork copies that array, which is an array of pointers, but it does not copy the make duplicates of the open file description. Okay. All right, cool. So this is sort of this is the mechanism and sort of the implications of being able to do sort of shell redirection. We've been looking at standard out, but hopefully you can see that if we just swapped in standard in, the same exact functionality would work, except the program is going to try to read from that rather than write to it. And so this lets us configure a process to sort of have the file descriptors that we want to be able to implement something like redirection. And that kind of leads into sort of the last piece here, which are pipes. Now, this is named to try to be intuitive, right? Because if you want to think of it sort of like with a diagram here, right? We basically have some sort of pipe. We can write into one side, and we can read from the other end. Now, why is this useful? So this is a helpful mechanism to allow two processes to communicate. Right? You kind of see how this would work. One process that wants to send something to the other is going to write into the pipe, and then the other process will read from that same pipe and receive that information. And this is a little bit cleaner of an abstraction than trying to, say, share an underlying file. Right? We don't necessarily want something written to like a file system. But because in Unix, kind of everything is a file, we're going to be able to use the same general API that we would for any file, except it's not actually going to refer to something like a file on a file system on disk. It's going to be a pipe, which the operating system is providing as functionality. And so when we have something like, .program, it's hard to write, sorry. And we have our pipe character, right? That's the same thing, right? So the way this is implemented is using a pipe, and then we can pipe that into, something else, right? P2. So this isn't the only way we can use pipes, but the shell can sort of set this up, run program. Anything that program outputs is going to be sent to a pipe, which will then be the input to our second program. All right, does the setup make sense? You can look at sort of a base case example here. And the function signature is not too complicated for the pipe system call. Except the sort of the major kind of difference from what we've seen before is that now, instead of sort of having kind of one file descriptor, we really need two, right? Because we've got two ends to the pipe. So we need one file descriptor we can write to and one file descriptor we can read from. And so that's why when we use pipe, we're generally going to have sort of syntax like this. We're going to create an array of two file descriptors. And then we call pipe, we pass in a reference to that array. And so this will allow the kernel to populate our array with the two new file descriptors. Like most things, it can fail. And so we want to check that and handle that error if it does. But the normal case is that it won't fail. And now we have our two file descriptors. The sort of guarantee from pipe is that the first one is the read end, and the second file descriptor is the write end. And you just have to use it that way. So now what do we do with that? Well, okay, we can read and write, okay? Call a write system call, write to the pipe, read, read. So again, looks just like any other file, it just happens to be this pipe construct. Yeah?
How does a pipe know what process it's connecting to?
How does pipe know which process it's connected to? Trying to think. So in one sense, a pipe doesn't, right? It's just a mechanism. And sort of anything with a file descriptor that refers to a file description, that's that pipe. It's almost more helpful, I think, to think about the other way. That has access to that pipe. So the pipe doesn't have to care per se. The kernel isn't sort of trying to assign a pipe to a particular process. It's more the other way around. The pipe exists, and processes which have file descriptors, which point to open file descriptions, which point to that pipe, can use it. That turns out to be very, very important, as we'll see in the next slide. Any other questions? Right, so the confusing thing here is keeping track of which side's the read side, which side's the write side. Probably just want to have the documentation up, especially when you're getting familiar with this, or if it's been a while, just to be able to keep track of which one's which. It's also helpful to just remap the variables, right, like this, just to sort of simplify and be able to keep track of that. Okay. So we can look at a more complete example. Like, when would this be useful? Well, we sort of mentioned that pipe is most useful for communicating between processes. So what's our so again, same structure here at the beginning. That's basically going to be the fairly boilerplate code for creating a pipe. Okay? Now, we can do, again, our friend fork. Same if statement, right? So we got zero, so that means we're in the child here, or if we get something greater than zero, parent, otherwise we get an error. Now what happened, right? We called fork, so we got the full copy, which means that in both processes, we now have read and write file descriptors, which are referring to the same pipe. Yeah?
Do you see that the child will write before the parent reads?
Is it guaranteed that the okay, so the, yeah, in this case, the child is writing and the parent is reading. No. Right? We don't like to say we have guarantees, because the operating system is scheduling these processes. We don't really have control over how that's going to work. And so we don't know the order that these are going to happen in terms of, like, if we think about some like wall global clock, you know, what actual ordering did these operations happen? So in our child process, basically we're trying to have the child be able to write data into this pipe and then have that be read by the parent. So that's kind of what we're trying to enable here. So what does that mean? Well, when we forked, we got copies, and so we don't need the read file descriptor in the child, because the child's only writing, so we can just close that. That's just going to close that file descriptor, right? The other process, the parent process, still has its file descriptor, so that resource will still be there. Now we can use that write file descriptor to write some data, and we can go ahead and say, yep, that's it, we're done. That's all we wanted to do, okay? And the parent basically does the inverse, closes the file descriptor, closes the write file descriptor because it's only reading, reads from it, waits for the child to finish before closing the other end of the pipe. Now, because we don't know exactly the order that these are going to happen in, we don't know if the child's going to run first or the parent, this read from pipe that happens to the parent is basically going to wait until there's data that's ready. And we won't see that, sort of, because we're using the same file abstraction, this read won't return that this file, we're at the end of the file, if there's still something that could write more data. And so this function, this read from pipe function, can sit there and read from that pipe and continue to get data until the other end of the pipe is closed. So we want to make sure that we close the here, make sure that we close the right end that the parent process has, so that the only thing that can write to it is the child process. We can keep reading from that pipe, and when the child process is finished with it, it will close the other end, and now the operating system will let us know and say, there's nothing left to read, because it's closed, there's no way for anything else to be written to this pipe, and then we can go ahead and handle that from there, right? Same with our sort of wait that we saw before, just to make sure that the child process has totally finished. And then we will, we can continue on with whatever the parent process wants to do. And so it's important that we close the ends that we're not using and close when we're finished, so that we don't, that the operating system can reclaim those resources. And so we're not sort of leaking these, like leaking memory, leaking these file descriptors, which the operating system keeps open because it thinks somebody might use it in the future, but actually this program is never going to do that. Okay, so that's a more sort of complete example. Questions? Anything unclear about that? Yeah.
Why couldn't a pipe just use a single file?
Why can't a pipe use a single file descriptor?
In the same way as like a file.
Charles, is there an easy or an intuitive answer for?
The functionality you're talking about with a single file descriptor with socket pairs is on the Unix. What they chose.
Yeah, so sort of a historical remnant of having the two for either end. There probably was some anticipated sort of use case or something that was going to help with. And then fast forward to when we talk about networking, we essentially have a very similar concept, but now we do only have the single file descriptor we can both read and write from. It's a good observation, though, that we're not really using both. Oh, yeah, sorry.
This program specifically, does it make sense to close the write file descriptor after you write the pipe with the child? Or does the exit do that for you?
Okay, so in this program, we basically have close written three times, right? We have close, close, close. But we have two file descriptors for the pipe, which we then fork, so we copy that. So now we have four file descriptors. We call it close three times. And so we never explicitly close the write file descriptor in the child process, which for sort of completeness, we certainly could have. But since we're exiting the process anyways, and that's going to basically clean up all of that process state, including that files list, and then the OS can check, okay, is that the last reference to any of those open file descriptions, and then I can take care of that. We don't need to do the explicit close, because we're just exiting anyways, but we could have. And so it might be sort of good practice to just sort of have all of that there when you're writing the code, just in case that later you're like, oh, actually, I need the child to do a little bit more, or something like that, and you want to make sure that pipe is fully cleaned up. All right. So that's sort of our main pipe example. If we wanted to look at a sort of a more complete example with the command line, and so here if we wanted to, this is something we often want to do, be able to run ls, so see what's there, and then pipe that into grep, which allows us to search through that, in case you want to search for a particular file listed there, or a string within a file name, for example, called foo. And so we have the mechanisms to do this at this point, right? We've seen all of the pieces we need. We create the pipe. We fork, so we have our pipe that we call fork. And look at that, okay, our if statements. Now, because we're at zero, right now we're in the child, so the child's gonna do this. So the child needs to set up that we want standard out. And so the first child, I guess we should look ahead a little bit, right? So we're gonna call exec with our first command here, which is ls. And so we wanna make sure that when ls outputs, it doesn't sort of go to terminal, we want it to go into the pipe so that we can send it to our second program. So to do that, we're gonna use our dupe two with standard out on the right end of this pipe, right? We have index one here, so that's gonna be the right. Now, we don't need the read side because we're going sort of out of ls into grep, so we don't need the read, so we close that. And we don't need our old copy of the write file descriptor because we've now duplicated a standard out. So we can go ahead and close that. Again, this makes sure we don't have any lingering references later. And then we can exec. And just like we saw last time, we don't need to handle anything after this because exec never returns. So that's that child. Now, the parent is not going to match this if statement, so the parent's going to go right to here. We want to run two programs, right? ls and grep, so we're going to have to call fork twice. So we get two child processes. Makes sense. Same if statement. So now this new process that forked at this point will enter this if statement here, and we're going to do something very similar. So eventually we're going to exec to grep, except now we're going to copy the read side of that pipe as standard in. We can close our old copy, close the write end. We're not going to use that. And then we exec. Again, exec's not going to return, so now this new child process that was executing here is now executing this new program, except when it reads from standard in, well, that's not going to be coming from the terminal. It's going to be coming from a pipe which is being written to by our other command. Now, the parent process isn't using this pipe. It's sort of put it to use with its two child processes, and so I can close its copy of these file descriptors. Clean up that state. So of course, this isn't sort of the, you know, there's a little bit more error handling we'd want to do for a complete example, but for what we can fit on the slide, it's kind of all there, right? We can do some pretty complicated pipelines using all of the pieces we've seen so far to enable the functionality that we've been using on the command line. Okay. If you want, we can also look at it with a sort of a diagram. So again, here's our parent. It created a pipe. It was the first thing it did. It called fork. That got us a child. Now that child exec, so it's running a new program. It's not running the program that we saw written there anymore. And then here, remember, here was our sort of setup window, right? So before we call exec, but after we forked, we have this place where we can set up these file descriptors so that the program runs how we want it to. We did that once, and then we did that again for a second child before executing our second command. And now essentially we have a pipe like if we want to diagram, right, we have a pipe basically between these two processes now when they're executing. But they're just, but the programs themselves are just using standard in and standard out like they always would. And our parent now no longer needs its copy of this pipe, and so we can just go ahead and close that. All right. So let's take a couple minutes, look at this example, and the question is, so we, you know, sort of same type of setup here. The child is trying to send A to the parent, but the parent actually reads 0 bytes instead of 1. You know, what happened? So again, discuss with your neighbors, take a couple minutes.
One way out the other.
All right. Any guesses? Any thoughts as to why this isn't going to work?
The parent process isn't for the child process to exit.
Ah, okay. The parent process isn't waiting for the child process to exit. Which, yeah, this is definitely sort of not what we've seen. You know, but we are sort of in the parent. We are calling read. And so as long as the other end of that pipe is still open, you know, read, if we're asking for a byte, is going to wait till we have a byte. So we should be okay. It's okay if the child exits earlier. Yeah.
Is it based on the stuff on the previous slide, is it because the pipe and the fork are in
a... Ah, okay. So if we look up here, right, we have fork and then we have pipe. And so what happens? So remember, we call fork, and this is why it's always one of these tricky things, right? It's returning twice. Now, each of those processes running this program is going to call pipe. And so as far as the operating system is concerned, two separate processes created two separate pipes, each with their own read and write file descriptors. And so essentially, the child process here, right, it is calling write to the correct end of a pipe. The problem is it's a pipe to itself, in effect. And so it's writing to one pipe that there's no reader, and the parent is reading from a pipe where there's no writer, because those are two separate pipes. And so when we're sort of writing code like this, we have to be careful that anything we want duplicated in both processes has to be set up before we call fork, so that we get the same resources in each process. All right, any questions on that? Okay, and so that was our sort of answer there. All right, and so that's kind of our summary of this Unix API related to processes. We've now can create processes, we can run new programs, we can open and close files or other, whether that's a file that's an actual file on disk or a network socket, etc. We can manipulate those file descriptors to get sort of interesting behavior like shell redirection, and we can do pipes and have communication between processes where they can read and write data to each other. All right. Cool? So we will definitely get some more practice with this in the next labs and homeworks. And you'll be able to try these out. And hopefully you'll keep in mind kind of all of the little questions that we've had. Any questions? We're not done yet, by the way. But any questions? All right, cool. And of course, if things do come up, I know a lot of you have been using Piazza, right? Feel free to ask questions there. If it's specific to your implementation, please use a private question. But I think that's a very effective way to get help. Okay. So we're going to take a quick little break while I get set up. But we're going to just introduce the next concept so we have a little bit of familiarity going into next week. Next topic is VM. And so the V is what V normally is, aka virtual. But M is not machine. In this case, it's going to be memory. Okay, so virtual memory. So we actually sort of saw this already, right? And this is one of these, like, really brilliant ideas that, frankly, really enables sort of the modern computing in a lot of ways. This idea that essentially every process gets all the memory it wants, and we can write programs assuming that, is incredibly powerful. And we saw this with our example where we had sort of two programs. They were using the same address, but they weren't conflicting with each other, right? And the reason is because of virtual memory. And so when we look at the program's address space, so like assume this is our sort of program with its state laid out, we have our addresses sort of starting from some low value, not quite zero, but some low value. We've got whatever constants we compile into the code. We have a heap that we can use, of course, our stack for our normal execution. And even on this sort of really big address space, right, a 64-bit address space, you know, we can sort of use wherever we want. And then the OS kind of has its region for all of the things that we've been talking about the OS needs there as well. And that's not going to be accessible to the process. But that's okay. We're already still talking about an enormous space for the program. So that part is going to be reserved for the operating system. Now, this is the program's view. Right? When we're running our program, this is sort of what it's seeing. But in reality, right, so the illusion here is this is all fake. Fake in the sense that the hardware is not doing this. Because we can't. Right? We don't have enough sort of physical memory, right, in this computer, right? The computer on your lap does not have enough memory to make these addresses actually work. And so this is all a lie, but it's a very, very convenient lie. And so this, because this illusion gives us the process can sort of be blissfully unaware of what's actually going on, the OS, on the other hand, has to manage the fact that it doesn't have sort of this like endless amount of memory. It's got fixed resources. It wants to provide this illusion to processes. And so to do that, it's going to maintain a mapping of wherever the process thinks it's writing to actual storage that it can really actually access. So here on the right, this is the actual, like, this is the real world. All right, this is memory that actually exists, that actually will store bits for us. And as you can see, it's not owned by a single process because we want to have multiple processes running at the same time. Right? Even if same time means they're time switched, they're still active, right? They still need to maintain their state. That's going to be in memory. And so we'll have some segments or pages that are for one process and some that are for another. Now, again, the processes, the programs over here have no idea this is happening. Right? And that's the beauty of virtual memory. And sort of this decoupling has, one, lets us use machines that don't have sort of essentially like what would be just infinite-ish memory. It lets us run multiple processes, and it allows us to run multiple processes that don't interact. Because remember, they have that full address space, yet when one process uses address 0x10,000, and another process uses address 0x10,000, that's not an address in real memory, that's an address in the virtual memory, and so the operating system can make those actually go to different places. So this is a very, very useful abstraction. Now, when we switch between processes, we do a context switch, we talked about restoring registers, we also have to restore this mapping, right? And that will get each process access to sort of its underlying physical memory accessible in its own address space. Questions? Good so far? Okay, so the high-level vision is hopefully, it still may be a little murky, but if we start to get the sort of idea that what we tell processes is true is not what's actually true, right? That's a key point. The OS is providing this mapping, so it's making this illusion real for processes. And this allows us to use what the limited memory we have while making our processes sort of easier, programs easier to write. But this red box, right? Okay, it's wonderful to say we're going to provide the illusion, but actually doing it is a different thing. And so that's where we will continue next week, discussing how we make virtual memory work. Thanks, everyone.